Case number 17-7057. United States of America, ex rel, Harry Barco and Harry Barco Appellant versus Halliburton Company et al. Mr. Cohen for the appellant, Mr. Elwood for the appellees.
Good morning. If it may please the court, Michael Cohen on behalf of the appellant, Harry Barco. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Okay.
This appeal concerns, among other things, the improper granting of summary judgment to KBR because the district court failed to consider the totality of Barco's circumstantial evidence and explicitly denied Mr. Barco the right to proceed on his implied false certification claim because he failed to produce, quote, direct evidence that kickbacks occurred. This holding is wrong as a matter of law because all False Claims Act claims can be established on the basis of circumstantial evidence alone. As Justice Thomas wrote, circumstantial evidence is not only sufficient, but may be more certain, satisfying, and pervasive than direct evidence. In this case, the evidence establishing a dispute of material fact is overwhelming. First issue of material fact we're looking at is whether there was a kickback scheme.
Can you explain to me your theory of implied certification with respect to kickbacks?
Yes. In Escobar, what you have is a situation, I think Escobar lays out a theory of implied certification, and the example Judge Thomas uses there, which is a piece of land, and they don't identify everything in the document that they say is true and correct. They just left out something because it should have been there. And the same thing goes to all the claims here. What KBR left out was that they knew that kickbacks were being paid, and they didn't tell the government about it. That they knew that they had an internal compliance program that was not functioning and not in compliance with the Anti-Kickback Act requirements, which was the only required requirement that had to be satisfied. It was specifically in the LogCAP 3 contract itself, the only self-reporting obligation found in the LogCAP 3 contract. And the government has made clear that kickbacks is of greatest concern to it because it affects all contracts and it could have such devastating effect that there needs to be clear and precise following of the Anti-Kickback Act regulations to ensure that the government is getting what it's paying for. And so in this case, you have KBR, every time they submitted an invoice that included payments from DNP, Downer Partners, they understood that Downer Partners was paying kickbacks, and they didn't tell the government about it. That's a theory.
And how do we know that that's material here when the government paid the 2012 certified claim?
Well, the government, first, the certified claim specifically includes a provision that says under the Contracts Dispute Act that paying the certified claim itself cannot be used to demonstrate that KBR cannot rely on that fact to demonstrate that if the government paid it with full knowledge of the problem. The Contract Dispute Act specifically says that the payment cannot be used as evidence that the government paid against the claim. That is because the real question is, why did the government require KBR to file the certified claim? That I believe, demonstrates that the government was unwilling to accept the veracity of the construction activity that was going on, and they required that final form of payment to be done in the form of a certified claim, knowing that that payment could not be held against the government, and that the government could still go after KBR for the fraud. And I think that...
How is that argument consistent with Escobar or Universal Health, whichever you want to call it?
Escobar, I think, makes clear that the government has to have actual knowledge. In this case, there is just no actual knowledge of kickbacks being paid, and there's no actual knowledge that there were false statements inserted into the certified claim itself. And more importantly, in KBR 2, the court identified that KBR's assertions would not be accepted at full value.
Well, I wrote KBR 2. That's not the way I interpret KBR 2. And that's a problem for you since I wrote it.
Well, I agree that I can only interpret what I read. And I think what KBR 2 does say is that there's a compliance factor and there's a attorney-client privilege factor, and the two are separate. They're not combined. And in this case, it's the compliance issues, the requirement that KBR comply with those requirements. You can't hide behind attorney-client privilege not to comply with a lawful requirement. If you like, I could go on to the crime fraud exception, but I think that there's still...
What's your theory on how that applies here?
The crime fraud exception?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Here's how I see the crime fraud exception. You have... KBR has established a code of business program required by law that it had to be created as a way of, as a management control to facilitate timely discovery and disclosure of kickback. KBR then crafts the program so that all of the allegations coming in, all the tips that come in that say kickbacks are being paid, can never trigger the reporting obligation. That's what Mr. Heinrich testified to at his deposition. And he says the reporting obligation can only be triggered as the result of the investigation that follows. So we know that the investigation that followed demonstrated that was direct and circumstantial evidence that kickback was paid, and based on that finding, a report had to be made. The lawyer who conducted the investigation was responsible for reviewing the report and was also the individual responsible for complying with the mandatory reporting obligation. As that lawyer, Mr. Heinrich could not either engage or assist his client in not submit the required disclosure based on the facts in the report. Instead, Heinrich actively assisted his client to conceal the fraud when he closed out the Code of Business Conduct investigation without making the lawfully required report to the government that kickbacks may have been paid. Mr. Heinrich gave the pretense of unconditional disclosure because the way the COBC operated, the investigation had to take place, and it was only on the basis of the investigation that the reporting obligation was triggered. And the government had a right to rely on that investigation. The government understood it was relying on those investigations. The government understood that KBR had to retain the investigative reports as a requirement under the AKA. And the government understood that those reports would be subjected to internal and or external audits to ensure compliance was happening. And Mr. Heinrich was actively involved with a DODIG that led to KBR receiving credits for active cooperation. So the government has this understanding that KBR is actively cooperating, is complying with its obligations, and that presented the pretense of unconditional disclosure when Mr. Heinrich got the report with the information saying that that kickbacks had been paid, triggering the obligation that Mr. Heinrich had to report to the government that a kickback may have been paid, and instead of doing that, he did the overt act of locking it away in a closet and not comply with his legal and ethical duty to tell the government what he read.
I think you wanted to save time for rebuttal, so we're into that time. Okay. Thank you.
I think I'm going to just make one point, and then if there are no further questions, we'll rely on our submission. But the point I wanted to make was that I think what Judge Lambert was talking about when he talked about direct evidence was not the difference between circumstantial evidence and direct evidence, whether there's, you have to draw an inference from it, but the fact that what Mr. Barco is trying to do here is have information about contracting irregularities serve to prove basically both of the big elements of a kickback. Ordinary, a kickback is a gratuity, and then you show that it was done for the purpose of improperly obtaining or rewarding favorable treatment. And what he's trying to do in the absence, really, of evidence of kickbacks on this account is to say, you know, there's so many contracting irregularities, that alone is circumstantial evidence of a kickback. And there is no case that he cites for that proposition. Every case he cites involves either direct evidence, such as in VAP or Dean or Vavra. There was testimony from the very people who gave the kickbacks. In Pretty, there was evidence of bank records showing transfers. And of course, in Hatch, there was circumstantial evidence, but it was evidence that the contractor who got the contract for consulting services got a $25,000 payment, deposited $19,000, and took $6,000 in cash in 1987, when it was even more unusual to be carrying around that kind of money, and took it to where the government official who gave him the contract was. And he gives you no authority for the proposition that it can serve double duty like that.
But here he's got a declaration from somebody who walks into a room, and there's a KBR employee and a subcontractor and an empty envelope on the table or desk. And in the KBR employee's hands is a stack of bills with a $100 bill on the top, and KBR employee sticks it in his pocket and says he was making change. I don't know that I've ever seen anybody make change with $100 bills. But maybe I don't run in the right circles.
Well, as the
So that looks like pretty good direct evidence to me, doesn't it?
But the thing is, you know, even after all the discovery that occurred here, he was unable to do anything to try to tie that instance to any of the subcontracts that occurred here. Mr. Poe isn't mentioned once in the 77-page complaint that mentions at least a dozen other people. He was a very peripheral figure. He didn't depose Mr. Poe before Poe passed on. And so, you know, we don't have really his take on anything. It's, you know, all we have is, you know, basically that, with nothing to tie it to the subcontracts at issue here. And the triple canopy stands for the proposition that you can't just, there would be unduly speculative to say that just because there was fraud in, you know, one instance means that it's universal and it can be applied everywhere. And
but
that's
why,
the only evidence has to tie to it.
Why, if we're taking all the inferences in the light most favorable to the non-movement here, the plaintiff, why can't we tie that to one of the subcontracts at issue here?
Because there's no evidence. You can only draw reasonable inferences, and there's no reasonable basis to say that of all the contracts that are swirling around, it was done with respect to this. And even beyond that, you don't have any evidence, again, that there was that it was material that resulted in the submission of a false claim. Now, Judge Lambert...
Is there any evidence about when this occurred?
I think there might be evidence of when... I mean, the only evidence we have...
I'm talking about the Poe thing.
I think the only evidence we have of when that occurred, and I might be wrong about this, is just the dates that we know that Poe worked there. And I honestly don't know exactly when it was. It was probably in kind of the ballpark range of 2003 to 2005. But I honestly don't know, as I stand here, exactly when that occurred. But certainly, Mr. Barco hasn't tied it to this. And, you know, when you have, you know, that little evidence of an actual kickback, I think that it's not enough to, you know, hold up the entire case. Because, you know, as they indicated in Triple Canopy, you have to, you know, tie the fraud to the actual case. And in this case, Judge Lambert said there was not any evidence that it resulted in any false claims. You can look through Barco's opening brief in this court for some theory about why it resulted in false claims and, you know, scratch your head because it's just not there. It doesn't really arrive until the reply brief when he starts saying, well, it's because they had an obligation to report and they failed to report that. But he doesn't ever explain why that would be material to payment, because if you look at the actual regulations at issue, which is of the FAR, it's 52.203-7, the regulation requirement is C2. It doesn't say anything at all about payment. You get to C4, and it says if there's a kickback, you can offset that. You may offset that. And the fact that there is no indication that the reporting requirement of reasonable grounds is tied to tied to payment, I think it's an uphill road to say that there's anything that would be material about the failure to report. And again, this didn't even occur until the reply brief, which is awfully late in the game.
You argue that the payment in 2012 demonstrates the lack of materiality.
I think it demonstrates the lack of materiality with respect to the certified claim. I think there are other reasons, like the one I just explained, why there's no reason to believe materiality, or at least not proof of materiality with respect to the rest of it. But I think it's undeniable that District Judge Lambert was correct that payment of the 2012 certified claim, 100 cents on the dollar, is a pretty good indication that it wasn't material, because after all, the government investigated this for 4 years, and then this is 5 years after they've had Mr. Barco's complaint. And after all of that, they thought that it was, you know, appropriate to pay 100 cents on the dollar, and I think both McBride and the Fifth Circuit's recent decision on Harmon stands very powerfully for the proposition that that's powerful evidence that it's not material.
But how do we know that the government was aware of this specific evidence? For instance, you know, this declaration of Mr. Ramey, because, and just by the way, he says that I think this happened between February 2004 to February 2005 when he was a site supervisor. I mean, this declaration isn't dated until 2015. So how do we know that the government was aware of the evidence that's presented here?
A couple of things. First, the government is served with copies of all of the documents in this case. And so, you know, the government is aware of, you know, when they start asserting the Ramey thing, that goes to an AUSA who was made aware of it. But more importantly is the things that the omissions that Mr. Barco says are material are the things that he identifies, like, which are things that are included in the complaint itself. Like he says, well, you didn't tell the government when you made that certified claim about these two inspection reports, these two engineering reports. But those engineering reports are part of the complaint. And so those are the things that the government has been on notice of since 2007. They're exactly the sorts of things, it's exactly the same inference that you can draw from McBride, that they were aware of the allegations there, and awareness of the allegations is enough to conclude it's not material. And I think that makes a lot of sense because, you know, under the sort of common law idea of what materiality is, if they're aware of the allegations and they don't investigate them, they probably weren't very important. And the only other alternative is that they investigated them and didn't find anything there, which, again, is another indication there was nothing material.
I have one question about the crime fraud. Judge Gwynne
talked about that at some length, the exception for those COBC reports, and rejected the claim. And after Judge Gwynne's decision, as I understand it, it was an appeal, and that's KBR 2. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. I can't find any indication that the plaintiff, Barco, raised the crime fraud ruling in his appeal in KBR 2.
That's correct. Well, it was our appeal. It was a mandamus petition. But it's true, and I think that's an additional basis, especially when you consider that.
So, just to round it off, it seems to me we don't have to consider that because Judge Gwynne's ruling is the law of the case and hasn't been challenged. Wasn't challenged when they had an opportunity to do it.
I don't know about law of the case, but certainly I think there's two bases for affirming on that ground. First, that it wasn't an abuse of discretion, which is the proper standard for that. But secondly, that he should have challenged it when he had the opportunity. He did raise alternative basis for denying mandamus in KBR 1, which wound up being the basis that was then later the subject of KBR 2, which was waiver. And so he certainly could have raised this crime fraud exception then. And I think the real kicker here is when this court said in KBR 2 that this they trusted this conclusively resolved this privilege issue. At that point,
definitively
right. Resolved this privilege issue. That would have been a very good point to raise their hand and say, well, there's one other issue here. And, you know, they don't have to ask for a rehearing on bank. It's enough they could just ask for panel rehearing to say that this is conclusively resolving this rather than lying in wait for another couple of years and bringing it up again.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
A few points. First, during mandamus action, we strenuously argued that the court didn't even have jurisdiction to hear the original case because a mandamus because attorney-client issues didn't trigger mandamus. That was our lead argument, and we argued forcefully on that. I think it would be disingenuous for us to put in our briefs and say, oh, by the way, just in case you want to disregard our argument, there's another one you should rule on. The fact is mandamus is controlled by the issues accepted by the court, and the waiver argument was not, first, because KBR won on the crime fraud, there was no possibility that ruling would have any adverse effect on KBR. And without the adverse effect, we could not establish jurisdiction. And that's why we didn't raise it. We just thought we just were lawfully prevented from doing so, that there was no jurisdiction that provided us an opportunity to do so. Second, I'd like to...
Because it was a discretionary ruling of the district court? Is that your point?
It was... No, but it was subject to the final appeal. And so instead of taking up a mandamus in the middle of the case, we understood that we were lawfully only allowed to raise it as part of our final appeal. And we just accepted. We said, okay, that's it. Well, you know, if we could have argued and raised it then, if we really thought we could, believe me, that was the one I wanted to win most. So I know that as far as the kickbacks, Mr. Ramey submitted a COBC complaint, so we can really time when he made those, which exactly when the investigation is going on. And it's important to note that the kickback, you're looking at happening at the exact same time, the same place, the same location, the trailer, in fact, where Mr. Gerlach spent most of his time instead of at KBR's trailers and DMP's trailers. And Mr. Poe is the site manager who reported directly to Mr. Gerlach.
Which contract did this corrupt?
The evidence demonstrates that all of the contracts identified in the amended complaint were corrupted, and for specific reasons. First, all of those contracts were locked away and secreted by Mr. Gerlach himself in his office in violation of KBR rules and regulations. That in and of itself is an indication that this set of contracts are troublesome. And you have also,
which contract did this particular payment, specific payment, corrupt?
VAVR does not require that payments be tied to a specific contract at all. It's enough to connect the gratuity with a specific kind of treatment. And in this case, the treatment is awarding contracts that shouldn't be awarded and turning your back on all sorts of problems in the performance of the contract. And also, you should also keep in mind that there was a second issue concerning a bribe in Susan Raku's declaration, where she confirms that she was offered a bribe of a satellite TV if she would agree not to enforce DNP's contracting standards. So it's not just one, there's two. And you have eyewitness accounts of Gerlach browbeating subcontract administrators. You have a DNP getting access to competitor pricing. You have terminating the employee who raised the fact that Gerlach had improper relationship with DNP. You have DNP getting contracts when they're not the lowest bidder. You have eyewitness accounts of DNP getting preferential treatment and eyewitness accounts that there was failed performance and no accountability. You had a private email account of communications between DNP and KBR. You had DNP with a Swiss bank account and no accounting standards that allowed them to freely flush money any which way they wanted. You had Mr. Dow, the owner of DNP, communicating with KBR's chief operating officer that a competitor had submitted a lower bid, and he wanted KBR's chief operating officer to weigh in on his favor, and he did. And you had the B6 man camp couldn't be terminated unless the chief operating officer was brought into the picture, and he didn't want it terminated for business reasons. You had DNP being identified as being the disqualified bidder and still being awarded the contract. You have the B6 man camp contract. You have the fact that they falsified in the contract documentations that the B6 subcontract had been awarded by Covelli when it had been awarded by Gerlach. And you had the B6 site manager saying the company that needs to get this contract is PPI because they're the most qualified. They're on site, and they've already done this exact type of construction timely for the government and of high quality. And he also writes an email saying that that KBR is incapable of timely performance and performing on that contract. The contract was a time of the essence, 90-day requirement. 19 months later, all that stood was a steel structure. They've had to build four dormitories. One steel structure for one of the four dormitories. That's it. No walls, no anything. And of that one steel structure, every well was defective, and the structure was condemned. And based on that construction activity in the certified claim, KBR claims they completed 50% of the contract. It's just simply mathematically impossible.
Okay, I think we have your argument. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors. Thank
Case
you.
Is submitted.